This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Liam Fox. Coming up, calls for Australia to create visas for Pacific climate change refugees. Pacific migrants on the verge of homelessness in Australia get help during the COVID pandemic. And PNG goes wild for local boy turned rugby league star Justin Olam ahead of the NRL Grand Final. But first, Fiji's government appears to be delicately balancing itself amid a geopolitical tussle between China and Taiwan after reports surfaced of an alleged physical altercation between their officials in the country. Both Beijing and Taipei have accused each other of initiating the incident that Taiwan claims left one of its officials concussed and in hospital. One foreign member of Fiji's diplomatic community says the incident demonstrates to him China's increasingly assertive behaviour in the Pacific. Evan Wasuka has more.
When Taiwanese officials hosted a reception at the Fiji capital's most grand hotel earlier this month for Taiwan's National Day, there were Taiwanese flags even on a cake. The guest list included Fiji opposition MPs and prominent business people, as well as two government MPs. One of them was Fisheries Minister Semi Koroela Vesau, who claims he was at the event as a private citizen and not representing the government. He says he only found out about the incident from local news reports.
I was not aware of the whole issue. It's only when I read the papers this morning and in the local papers here and I read about it. I was not aware of it before.
China claims Taiwan as part of its territory, and its foreign affairs spokesperson, Zhao Lijian, described the National Day celebration as, quote, a provocation.
Taiwan was like a thief calling, stop the thief. The Taiwanese institution in Fiji blatantly displayed the self-styled flag, and its cake was also decorated with a self-styled flag. On that very evening, the staff of the Taipei Trade Office in Fiji spoke and acted provocatively against the Chinese embassy staff who were carrying out their official duties in the public area of the same hotel where the event was held. One Chinese diplomat was injured, with the belongings also damaged.
But Taiwan's Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister Harry Ho Jianzheng says Chinese officials tried to force their way into the October 8th event at the historic Grand Pacific Hotel. Alban Ishoda, who's the Marshall Islands ambassador to Fiji, says that's something he sees happen often at official events.
It was a normal occurrence to have Chinese nationals present at the entrance of the hotel where the event are taking place. Now, I assume collecting information on people attending the celebration for Taiwan National Day.
Ambassador Ishoda was also at the function, but says he didn't see anything.
I understand Taiwan does not show up to events that are hosted by People's Republic of China. So, you know, it's just being respectful. And let, I guess, the our leaders back, whether it's in Taipei or in Beijing, to work out what they need to work out. But just a show of physical force is, I think, it's very unnecessary and inappropriate, especially in a public setting.
The Marshall Islands is one of Taiwan's four remaining allies in the Pacific. And Ambassador Ishoda says while that's his government's policy, it doesn't shape his view on the allegations of violence or the way the Fiji authorities have handled the situation. Fiji doesn't have formal diplomatic ties with Taiwan, but has informal links through its trade office in Suva, which was forced to change its name in July from the Trade Mission of the Republic of China, Taiwan, to the Taipei Trade Office under pressure from Beijing.
Of course, their relationship with Fiji is it's Fiji's prerogative. We have no intention of meddling in that relationship in any way, shape, or form. But the treatment that they received from the reports and from our understanding of the evening should be cause for concern, because our view is that any way to resolve disputes is the best way to do is through dialogue and through partnership.
But he is critical of China's response and its accusation that Taiwan officials had acted provocatively.
My initial reaction is, well, you know, why would you feel provoked if you weren't invited in the first place? Of course, you know, had people kept to their own zones and areas, then it would have been, you know, we would have avoided that. The unfortunate events, as we came to learn, the tussle between the two sides, created and sort of, you know, took us back to a number of, particularly how mainland China has been sort of asserting itself in the way the region conducts its business.
The Australian government is being urged to introduce a new visa system that would allow Pacific Islanders to relocate permanently to Australia to help manage the impact of climate change in the region. The recommendation is contained in a new policy paper that will intensify pressure on the federal government to do more to help neighbouring countries. Susie Raines has the details.
When families come together, they talk about the stuff that matters, that's most important to them. And over the next few days, that's exactly what we'll be doing.
This is Australia's Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, speaking at the Pacific Islands Forum last year from Tuvalu, one of several island nations under threat from rising sea levels.
There will be realisation and recognition of the plight that people in Tuvalu are facing.
As host of the event, Tuvalu's Prime Minister, Anele Sapawanga, joined other Pacific leaders in pressing Australia on climate change. Now, the federal government is being urged to do more to support its Pacific neighbours affected by global warming.
What we don't want to see is a situation as we have with COVID-19, where we have to scramble with emergency measures. We have an opportunity still to be able to plan, but we need to seize that opportunity now so that we're not left scrambling at the last minute.
Professor Jane McAdam is the director of the University of New South Wales Andrew and Renata Kaldor Centre for International Refugee Law. She's co-authored the new policy brief that's described as a roadmap for Australia to deal specifically with the displacement of Pacific Islanders as a result of climate change and natural disasters.
What we do know is that because disasters are likely to increase both in their intensity and frequency, it means that people's normal adaptation capacity is almost being overtaken. Things are happening too quickly for them to be able to respond and avoid displacement altogether. And I guess if you look at where the trajectory is, unless we have major changes in mitigation and adaptation efforts, we're likely to see more displacement occurring. Like any insurance policy, it's making sure we have the right tools there so that if we need to activate them, we can.
One of the tools proposed in the brief is permanent migration to Australia for a small quota of Pacific Islanders under a new visa that could be modelled on a New Zealand scheme. Professor McAdam acknowledges the merits of existing visa programs that allow Pacific Islanders to live and work in Australia on a temporary basis, but she says offering permanent relocation would not only help fragile Pacific countries adapt to climate change by taking the pressure off stretched resources, but it would also supplement Australian aid to the region.
What's interesting, I think, is that in a study that it did, the Lowy Institute found that if only 1% of the Pacific's relatively small population were permitted to work permanently in Australia, this would bring more benefits to the people of the Pacific than Australia's entire aid contribution to the Pacific region.
Jonathan Pryke is from the Lowy Institute and he's also a co-author of today's new policy brief that he says has been drafted in Australia's national interest.
We want a stable and prosperous immediate region. It's at record numbers now. Just the aid program alone is at $1.6 billion this year, which is sorely needed because of the COVID crisis that the region is facing. But when it comes to labour mobility, you basically spend nothing at all. You know, these people come in and are actually a boon to the Australian economy. They fill severe labour shortage needs. They help get fruit off the vine. They help in aged care and childcare and other sectors. These people can remit money home. They can improve the wealth and prosperity of the nations they're coming from. So it's a win-win policy that comes at a very low expense to the taxpayer.
And a win, he says, that requires only a very low intake, no more than 3,000 permanent migrants from the Pacific each year.
We are advocating for a real drop in the ocean here with regards to our overall migration scheme. You know, we've done some modelling where we estimate, 1% of the Pacific population's moving to Australia by 2040, so a 20-year period. This is not a radical proposal. We're not suggesting opening the gates to the region. You know, it's an important component of helping improve welfare in the region, but also being an important mitigating tool for climate change displacement. Many Pacific Islanders, of course, want to remain at home with dignity, but the reality is that if the modelling proves to be correct, it's going to be very challenging for some Pacific Islanders to do that.
That's Jonathan Pryke, the director of the Lowy Institute's Pacific Islands program, ending that report from Susie Raines. The COVID-19 pandemic has been bad news for many people, but in Australia, some of the most vulnerable are migrants, including those from the Pacific. That's because they're not eligible for most, if not all, welfare benefits available to Australian citizens who fall on hard times. But in Brisbane South, one organisation is helping Pacific Islanders at risk of homelessness find jobs. One of their success stories is a PNG woman who was on the verge of being kicked out of her home, along with her husband and two young children.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, Vanessa.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Please come through.
In Logan in Brisbane South, employment mentor Vanessa Neuenhuizen welcomes Anne Corey into the office of the not-for-profit group YFS. Anne has some good news.
I'm working.
That's amazing.
I know. I've got, in fact, three of them.
Oh.
So I've decided to drop one.
Yeah.
And just work on two. I know that probably two is too much, but I need it right now to help us get on our feet and
That's
be on
fantastic.
Top of our bills and everything.
Yeah. That's fantastic news.
It's a remarkable change of fortune for Anne. She and her husband moved to Australia 2 years ago from PNG to find a better life for their two young children. Her husband was working as a mining engineer, flying in and out of a natural gas project in the PNG Highlands. But when COVID-19 struck and international borders were closed, he was stuck in Australia and lost his job.
It was hard. It was really hard because here in Australia, it's different to where we come from. Australia, you need to have money. You must have money to survive, to pay for this and that, and everything is money. As opposed to where we come from, we have family support, we have gardens. You know, there's things that we can always fall back on.
Anne travelled to Australia on what's known as a New Zealand citizen family relationship visa because of a former marriage with a New Zealand man. That meant she wasn't eligible for welfare payments, family tax benefits or subsidised healthcare.
Therefore, meaning if my kids fell ill, I had to, you know, fork it out of my pocket to pay for it. And it was really difficult.
Anne and her family got by with the help of church groups and other organisations that provided food and other bits and pieces. But the bills were mounting, especially the rent.
We're having rent arrears, eviction notices coming out. You got to get out, you're not paying and all that. It's like, oh my gosh, we really need to do something or else we'll be out on the streets.
What they needed was a job and a regular income. And then someone told them to get in touch with YFS and Ms. Neuenhuizen, who runs what's called the Spark Program, which only began in March, around the same time as the COVID-19 pandemic hit.
Tailored specifically for, I would call them, the people that fall through the cracks, cannot access Centrelink benefits or mainstream employment services because there's requirements and they do not tick the boxes.
She helps people who are homeless or those like Anne who are at risk of becoming homeless find employment. Ms. Neuenhuizen says a lot of those people falling through the cracks are migrants from New Zealand and the Pacific.
50% of the referrals that have come through and the people that I've worked with since the start of the program are New Zealand citizens and Pacific Islanders, simply because of that they're not eligible for the benefits. What else can they do? The only thing that they need to do is to find work.
She noticed Anne had a PNG diploma in nursing and organised training for her to get local qualifications. But before the training had even started, Anne had three job offers thanks to Ms. Neuenhuizen's network of employers. She's taken up two of them, one caring for a man with a disability, the other caring for a cancer patient.
I was overjoyed. Yeah. I don't know the right word to use right now, but the only thing that comes to my mind is overjoyed. I was just overjoyed, overwhelmed with the relief of all this stress and worry, and it was a relief, yeah.
The Spark program is only a trial at this stage and has funding until January next year. Ms. Neuenhuizen hopes it will continue in some form.
Anne is just one example, but there's so many others that have been blessed by this program. It's not just putting people into employment. We've paid for licenses. We've paid for studies, courses, tickets. Anything that is a barrier to someone gaining employment, we've helped them, and that's what we do.
That's Vanessa Neuenhuizen from YFS. An appeal for help by the captain of Papua New Guinea's rugby sevens team has gone viral on social media. Hima Alu has a serious knee injury, and without proper assessment and treatment, it's unlikely he'll play top-flight rugby again. So he's decided to raffle off one of his international jumpers to raise the funds he needs. As Richard Hewitt reports, Hima's plight has exposed a system which can do very little for elite players who suffer injuries that would be routinely dealt with in more affluent countries.
The last time Hima Alu was in action for his country was at the World Sevens Challenger Series in South America back in February. But he was far from being 100% fit and battling on with an injury he'd already endured for more than 2 years.
I fell awkwardly on my knee in a tackle. I ended up injuring my meniscus. That's pretty much the cartilage in between the knee joint and the lower leg. And I've just been managing it over the last couple of years, rehab and strapping during games. And probably in the process, I've just kept on injury even more to a stage where one of the games against Uruguay, I was just stretching and the cartilage just sort of popped out.
At that point, Hima realized he couldn't play on any longer, but getting his knee fixed was never going to be easy. Former Sevens coach Dougie Guise, who gave the player his international debut, says there is no backup system in place in PNG.
Yeah, we don't have that great system here going around with our insurance and players and all that. Not many insurance companies are willing to help out with PNG rugby. A lot of players, by the time they're like Emma's age, 28, 29, the chronic injuries start catching up with them. So instead of peaking at this age with the experience of playing and whatnot, they're already on a quick decline.
So where does World Rugby fit into the picture as the sport's global ruling body? Dougie Guise says, sure, they put money into PNG rugby, but when it comes to injuries, it's every player for himself.
I think World Rugby does give us development grants and whatnot, but I don't think we're in that tier where we can ask for more sort of thing. I think that's mainly for the big countries and the top tier nations, yes. I don't think we're eligible for much of those big grants here.
And in Hima Alu's case, he didn't want to burden his club, and that's when he came up with the idea of raffling the jumper he wore at the Oceania Sevens online.
The competitions here are pretty much amateur. Finances side, there's not a lot involved. It's more or less like a social thing, so I didn't want to go back to my club and ask them, so I said, okay, I have a number of jerseys here, so I might as well just raffle one of them and probably start something, and probably the public or rugby community in general can just chip in wherever they can.
Do you feel sad that you're having to do this? Do you feel angry?
It's quite a sad fact that I have to deal with, that I have to go through the process of raising funds, and it's not a good feeling, but I still want to play, so this is probably the road I have to take now.
And the money is starting to come in now, with Pacific Rugby Players Welfare also putting up a signed Flying Fijians jumper for auction on Hima Alu's behalf. Well, right now it seems that the rugby community is doing its very best to look after Hima Alu, and he's very optimistic now that he will get the funds he needs and he will take to the field for Papua New Guinea once again.
I thought what I was doing was just going to be something local, seeking help from families and friends, but I didn't realize that it would go viral, and I didn't want to paint a bad picture of PNG rugby or my club. I'm still 28 years old, so I know I still have a lot of rugby in me, and I can give back to my club and the country. So yeah, I'm pretty determined to get my knee fixed. The response has been so enormous, and it got me emotional a number of times, just seeing how the community here in PNG and the South Pacific, how they responded. It's inspirational. I have a good feeling I'm going to get this knee sorted out as soon as possible. It's looking good now.
Injured right now, but not for too much longer, we hope. That's the captain of the PNG Rugby Sevens team, Hima Alu, and the reporter was Richard Hewitt. Now, I don't need to tell you that people across the Pacific will be excited to watch the NRL Grand Final this weekend. And in PNG, the excitement levels will be through the roof when their much-loved son, Justin Olam, takes the field. The 26-year-old has gone from playing with a plastic Coke bottle stuffed with grass in a small village to making his grand final debut for the Melbourne Storm.
They're playing for the Proben Summons Trophy, and the grand final is underway.
This weekend's NRL Grand Final will see the Penrith Panthers take on the Melbourne Storm, but the game's been described by many on social media as the Penrith Panthers versus PNG, and that's because of this man.
Olam here, reaching out, plants it down.
Now, Cam Smith on the last, back to the left. Oh,
Justin Olam!
What about that pass?
Since
Since joining the Melbourne Storm in 2018, Justin Ollam has brought his fans in his rugby league-loving home country along for the ride. Whenever the PNG International is playing, large groups of people will cram around a TV to watch Ollam's every breakaway, sidestep and tackle.
You know, big games we like to watch as a community.
That's Leonard Leo in Port Moresby.
Now when the Storm are playing and when we know that Ollam will be playing in the first 13, then we gather around front of a canteen, a tackle box or someone's front yard or backyard or, you know, just a small 14-inch or 21-inch TV and, you know, there's like 30 people, 40 people around watching and we're all cheering on. When he's tackling hard or when he gets tackled, you know, everyone reacts differently, but especially when he scores a try, then that's it. You know, everybody's just shouting and then, you know, everyone's excited, jumping up and down.
Tommy Isaac with his first touch. Pappenhausen's kick ricochets. There we go again. Ollam's got three!
Gathering around in the village to watch a rugby league game is a tradition that Justin Ollam knows well.
You know, speaking from experience that myself growing up back in PNG, when it's a big game like Grand Final or State of Origin, 90% of the people go and watch the game, so that's going to be millions of people sitting around the TV, I guess. Yes, they always love their rugby league back at home, but especially my friends and my close friends and my family, they're really happy for me. They're proud of me to make it this far to the Grand Final, and yeah.
Preparations are well underway in the Highlands town of Kundiawa, where Ollam grew up, to make sure that no one misses their hometown hero make his NRL Grand Final debut. Rita Parkey is a journalist for the Post Courier newspaper and based in another Highlands town of Mount Hagen. She says there's excitement on the streets already.
Some people are dressed in purple. They're wearing the Melbourne Storm jerseys, sold in Asian shops. Most people are very happy. They're even in the vehicles, the cars, you can see the colour pattern being carried around in the towns and on the streets. Basically, the way I see the people's behaviour, they are telling me that Justin Ollam is someone that is confident when he's playing and is bringing the title PNG Boy in Melbourne Storms.
Meanwhile, back in Port Moresby, Leonard Leo will even be switching team allegiances this weekend just to cheer Ollam on.
Personally, I support the Dragons, but, you know, this time around, this year, we'll be supporting our fellow countryman, Justin Ollam, for the Storm. Yeah, just massive support from PNG. And, yeah, especially the Melbourne Storm supporters all around the country. So, yeah, we're looking forward to the game on Sunday and hopefully he can give us a good result and, you know, get the win. So
yeah,
everyone's behind me, trust me, everybody.
And if having a country of around 8 million people follow his every move is putting pressure on the 26-year-old, then he's not letting it show. Ollam, who has a degree in applied physics, says come game day, he'll be sticking to what he knows.
Yeah, it's unreal. Me, personally, just try not to think about it. It's treated as a normal game and my preparation is just same thing. I'm not adding new things into my preparation. It's just the old same things that I've been doing.
Michael Marram is someone who knows Ollam well. He's the coach of the PNG Kumuls, the national team, and selected the centre for both the Kumuls and the PNG Hunters who compete in the Queensland Cup. Marram says that Ollam has always been a hard worker on the field.
We brought him into camp. He impressed right away with his, you know, attitude towards training, his willingness to work really hard at training. He was aggressive. He wasn't scared of the big boys at that time. He put his body on the line every time he had training.
That's PNG Kumuls coach Michael Marram ending that report from Talia Olatia. And that's it from Pacific Review. Remember, if you can't listen to Pacific Beat live, you can subscribe to our free podcast. Just type Pacific Beat into your favourite podcasting app on your phone or on your computer. Or if you'd like to find certain stories, you can find them on our website. Just search for Pacific Beat and ABC. You can also follow us on Facebook, find and like the Radio Australia page, and you'll be able to get our stories in your feed. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.